There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile on a Monday. I'm back. Fresh week to work with. Glad you are along. Lots to do over the next 2 hours. Phone line, text line, 343-0106. Dalton, you can see the... I did put the picture up on Twitter. Somebody was asking, I still have that red sweater. I don't think so. Don't think it fits so much. The picture we put up there, and it'll make sense later on in the hour. Quinn Hillier is going to join us to talk about the legacy of former AL1 Congressman Jack Edwards. Just put a picture up of the first time I met the congressman. I was a little too young to vote for the congressman back then, but I put that picture up on the Twitter feed. So that's coming up in the second half of this hour. And this half of the hour, our buddy Todd Stacey from Alabama Daily News, aldailynews.com, joins us. Lots to talk about with him. Hey, Todd.
Hey, Sean, how's it going?
It's good. I'm going to talk about a conversation we were having before we went on the air during the news break, because I think this is, I sensed it, but I am a rank amateur. I was in Washington last week doing radio when the impeachment, I think I was actually flying into Washington when I saw the, I think it was the Charlotte airport, when I saw Pelosi making the announcement for the impeachment proceedings, and then get to Washington. And of course, we were talking about some immigration stuff there, but I would look at the people I was interviewing and said, yeah, we'll talk about immigration for a second, but obviously, you want to talk this impeachment thing, and the city felt electric. Capitol felt electric with all the discussion going on there. From your time working in Washington, you said there were times like that would just be a buzz around the city.
Yeah, I was telling you, you know, I don't miss D.C. all the time. I certainly don't miss all the politics and how it's gotten. But times like that, I kind of do miss it, because there's just something different. There's something different in the air. It's electric. You can feel just sort of the buzz. And look, I'm not saying you have to be a fan of impeachment or anything like that, but there's just something different when there's a huge thing happening, a big election. I remember, you know, Speaker Boehner resigning, you know, just different moments, inflection points where there's just something different. And so it is kind of fun just to be around that. Now, of course, if you're working in the middle of it, sometimes you have some pretty long days, and that's not fun. But at the end of it, you know, people are going to go to their favorite watering hole, you know, drown their sorrows or celebrate or whatever it might be. And it kind of is a lot of fun. So I thought it was great that y'all were in town during that week, because it is unique.
And what you mentioned about the long days, I got a chance to see that too, seeing staffers for, and I won't even get specific which staffers, but staffers for a couple different Alabama members of Congress. And they were, I mean, they had like a stare on their face, like they'd just come out of a war room or something like that. They said, we've been...
Well, yeah, because they're getting it from, you know, they're getting it from the media, mm-hmm. you know, they're getting it from other members, you know, colleagues. They're getting it a lot from the constituents, people calling up the phones. I mean, that phone line rings all day long on days like that with, you know, people calling saying impeach the guy or defend the guy or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, it's nuts. And so, yeah, I do have a special sympathy for staffers on times like that.
Yeah, they're answering lots of calls and trying to figure out what the responses are going to be. And what should the responses be? As you look at this, that, you know, and we went through the procedure again on the morning show, you know, I have a feeling that the president will be impeached. In other words, the House will vote on articles of impeachment and impeach. Of course, that doesn't mean anything unless the Senate votes 2/3 to convict. But the process of the House members voting to impeach, the Democrats that are in Trump-friendly districts, what would it like to be that staffer now? Somebody who is a Democrat who won a House seat, but that's an area of the country or that district voted for Trump in the presidential. What's their life like right now?
Well, that's really difficult. And there's not too many districts that, you know, are currently very Trump-friendly and also Democratic, but there's a few of them.
I think there's six. Five or six.
Yeah. And that's really difficult. But there are plenty of districts. Remember, when Democrats won the majority this past time in 2018, they won it from these swing areas, a lot of suburban areas, like, you know, Southern California used to be completely Republican, Orange County, all that, completely Republican. Now it's completely Democratic. So in places in North Carolina, all around the country, these suburban areas. Well, I wouldn't call those necessarily completely pro-Trump, but they are moderate and they're swing. And they care a lot more about how the economy's doing, whether or not we're going to get a trade deal, whether or not we're going to get a prescription drug deal to bring down those crazy costs. That's what they care about. They're not necessarily worried about this back and forth between the president and Democrats on impeachment. So, yeah, it's Democrats in those areas who right now, during this two-week recess, have had to go home and have those meetings at the Rotary Club, have the town hall, and all these places, and they're answering questions from folks saying, you know, maybe not bought in on impeachment. And so what do? Do they try to sell them? Do they try to sell those people, those maybe moderates that are on the fence saying, we must press forward with this impeachment? Or are they hearing some feedback to say, hey, you know, we sent you up there to get some deals done on economic issues and healthcare issues and things like this, not to go pick a fight with Donald Trump. That's where I think some of the rub might be. And when those folks come back to Washington, it'll be interesting to see if there's any feedback from the congressional districts.
Wait, flip this around for a second then let's talk about something here at home. Move to the more austere body of the legislative branch and talk about the Senate and your Senator Doug Jones right now. And you see that this is going to be heading your way, coming out of the House, heading to the Senate.
Well, look, I mean, it's not like he asked for this. And in fact, it's probably about the worst thing that could happen for him in terms of, you know, reelection. Mm-hmm. He was always going to have an uphill battle. But this pits him, you know, right up against the President of the United States. If the president gets impeached and it actually goes to a trial in the Senate, then, yeah, he's going to have to make a vote for or against, not for a nominee, not for a bill, not, you know, legislation or something like that, but for or against removing the President of the United States from office. And that's from a state like Alabama, that's either or proposition in a state that a lot of people support the president. So unless something really turns, right, unless some kind of real smoking gun thing happens and public opinion completely turns against President Trump, that's a really tough vote to make. You know, kind of maybe his head against his heart on that one.
Now, okay, this, give it with your insight, timeline on this. I asked that question last week, and maybe you can help me understand it better. If I was a Democrat, from strategy here, I wouldn't have wanted this to hit right before we went home for 2 weeks. I thought I would want it to hit when we had a lot of time to talk about it. Some people say it's a good move from Democrats strategically. But what do you think the timeline is? House is out maybe for 2 weeks here. Then they come back. They got to, have the articles, the vote on the articles. I mean, is this something that's done before Thanksgiving, something that's done before the new year? What do you think?
Well, you're right. I mean, if in a perfect scenario, they would have gone on this months and months ago, but they're captive from the actual allegations themselves, right? I mean, this is pretty new information. Of course, it's newer to some than it is others. We can talk about that later. But yeah, look, they're pouncing on this because they know that the timeline has to be short. Number one, we're close to an election, and they know that, you know, voters are not going to support trying to remove the president in an election year. They have to get this done if it's going to be legitimate or perceived as legitimate, as soon as humanly possible. The second thing is they've really got to get going before Republicans have a chance to get back on their feet, collect themselves, and start responding. You know, think about the Mueller report. Think about the last two big battles. One was the Mueller report, mm-hmm. which lasted for 2 years. But really, when it hit its inflection point, Republicans were prepared. They were on their feet. They came back with not just a defense and an explanation, but aggressive messaging. And they won that battle. They won the day. It went away. The second is the Kavanaugh confirmation. I mean, both huge, instances of Democrats having going with everything they have at the president and at his nominee. But Republicans were prepared. They fought back and eventually won the day. In this circumstance, Republicans have been caught off guard. The president has been caught off guard because nobody knew about this. And so it's had to take a few days, and it may take a few more days, maybe even a week, for Republicans to get back on their feet, figure out what the sort of talking points are, what the facts are, how they can poke holes in the Democrats' arguments. And Democrats know that. So that's why they're trying to move as fast as they can,
gotcha.
Because they know that they've caught Republicans off guard.
All right, we come back from the break. I want to talk about poking holes in that. And also, this whistleblower, what makes a whistleblower? How many degrees of separation? What kind of protections? We keep our conversation going. Todd Stacey, Alabama Daily News, aldailynews.com. Got to go to the website when we come back. He'll also tell you how to get signed up for his fantastic email that you get 6 days a week. Pretty good stuff.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 1220 FM Talk 106.5. Welcome back. Midday Mobile online at FMTalk1065.com, which, by the way, online opinion poll question brought to you by 1-800-GOT-JUNK. You can check that out. Should the identity of the White House whistleblower be released? Right now, 88% of y'all say yes. The rest of you say no. Todd Stacey from Alabama Daily News says what?
Oh, I think that would be a bad precedent. Well, here's the only thing, and we can get into the whistleblower stuff, because, yeah, the rules changed, and I think that does look suspicious. I mean, you can say what you want to about the nature of the complaint and pick it apart, but I worked with some whistleblowers over the years in government, and especially a couple years ago with the Veterans Affairs scandal, I worked with some whistleblowers, so I take that really seriously. And it's a very bad precedent to set to even come close to revealing their identity, especially it's something as high up as the CIA. So even if you can choose sides over what the whistleblower complaint means and all that kind of thing, but I think we can. It would set a bad precedent for the country to start revealing those sources.
You know, I was saying that this morning. I said the same thing. I said, you get your partisan out of it and think about the overall for the whistleblower. So I agree with you there. But I think the nuanced question is, how far do those protections go? How many degrees of separation from the initial person that saw it firsthand do you give protection? Because it could be like the telephone game, right? I mean, by the time it gets to two, three, four levels gone.
Well, I do think the whistleblower has an obligation to report to those that can protect them, like the inspector general. That's what they're there for. Now, with some agencies, I don't trust that. I didn't trust it with the VA. I never trusted their inspector general. You'd like to think that somewhere like the CIA, you could trust an inspector general. So I hope so. But yeah, look, I think the job of Congress, whatever you think about how this whistleblower complaint came about and how it got out and everything, the job of Congress is to investigate it and see where it goes, see where the evidence leads. We know that the Democrats are going to lean really heavily into whatever this thing says, impeaching the president. We know that. You already mentioned that. But what's going to be, it does get a fresh airing. So, yeah, we might not need to know who the whistleblower is, but all this information that they allege and the fact that it's secondhand really only works to the president's advantage, mm-hmm. especially if Republicans on the Judiciary Committee can point out inconsistencies or missing facts, gaps in knowledge and things like that. So the fact that it's secondhand, that only works to the benefit of the president if they use it right.
All right, let's bring it back to Alabama and remind folks, too, they could be reading about this if they got that email in their inbox this morning. How do they sign up for your daily email?
Yeah, it's really easy. It's just aldailynews.com. That's the website. And you see subscribe right there at the top of the page. Just click that. Enter your name and your email. There's no cost. It's free. But you'll be on the list. And every morning we send out the daily news. Today, yeah, we had a ton of news, including some analysis on impeachment, some polling data, and all kinds of different news from the state of Alabama. So, yeah, please, we'd love to have you as a subscriber.
Yeah, I want to get into that polling data story here because it's funny you said it's a way too early poll in Alabama's 2nd Congressional District. You know what
way
that is?
Way too early.
Okay, to the political animals that love this radio station, that is just the biggest temptation. It's not too early. They're always ready to talk some polling. So you've got some polling for AL2. Give them the red meat here.
Yeah, so obviously Alabama's 2nd Congressional District, that's Montgomery down southeast to Dothan. Martha Roby has decided to retire after 10 years in Congress. And so the newest entrant into that race is Troy King, and he had some internal polling data that he shared with our organization showing him doing very well. His name ID in the district is 88%. He leads it's very strong. I mean, and he leads a snapshot horse race with 38%. I mean, I'm sorry, 34% of the vote. So I mean, both those numbers are very strong, way above anybody else. But I also included some caveats. Number one, like you said, it's really early. The field has not settled. Troy King hasn't even had an official announcement, nor have two or three of the other candidates that we expect to get in. So, it's unlike the Senate race where everybody pretty much knows who's running. A poll in the Senate race is pretty reliable because we know.
Mm-hmm.
Here we don't know. And so before the field is really settled, polling can be a little suspect. So that's number one, is it's really early. Number two, they had a relatively low number of respondents, meaning number of people they actually polled. That was 303 respondents. Typically in the congressional district, I'd like to see it 600 or north of 600. That'll give you a margin of error of three. You like it around three, that'd be nice. This margin of error was 5.8% plus or minus. That's high. So that these are some caveats that good for Troy King. He's obviously got a ton of name ID. He's obviously leading because of that name ID. But there are some caveats in this that, make you say, a little grain of salt here.
All right. The shift, you mentioned the Senate race and the names, the known products there. What do you make of that Alpha endorsement? And maybe it's not Alpha, it's the overall, I forget. It may Alabama Farmers, because people said there's some division split between the insurance and the other part of the Farmers.
Yeah, they like us to say Alabama Farmers Federation, which is true because they have an insurance business that is separate from
us.
Let's
be accurate. I want to be accurate.
This is the Alabama Farmers. This is the agriculture community in Alabama. And so, yeah, their endorsement of Tommy Tuberville was a very big deal. We were all waiting Tuesday because we knew everybody, all their membership was meeting here in Montgomery. And it's a big deal. It was a big deal during the 2018 elections. It really swung some of those races. Remember Will Ainsworth.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody thought he was going to challenge Twinkle Andrus the way he did. And suddenly that Alpha endorsement really boosted him up. So things like that. And they had a really good track record. I think it's a pretty big deal. It's a big disappointment more than anything for Bradley Byrne. And look, Bradley Byrne has been there in Congress almost 6 years now, and he's been friends with the agriculture community. He's been voting their way,
mm-hmm.
Carrying the water for them. And so for them not to support him, kind of return the favor there, was a pretty big deal. And I think he'll remember that, as will some of the other delegation, I'm sure. I mean, that was a big deal. But it just shows you how Tuberville has really kind of come in and changed the paradigm in this race, not just among uninformed voters, but among some of the establishment, among some of those who are very involved in the process.
Okay. So, I mean, I heard they had to, you know, take that second ballot up there, which to me must mean the first one was tied. It had to be. I mean, this is, am I wrong in saying this has really been between Tupperville and Byrne, you know, up till, you know, that's been the two. I know there are others running. We can talk about it. But the two players are Tupperville and Byrne.
Yeah, and from what we understood, the voting came down to less than 10, maybe like 5 or 6 votes.
Wow.
That decided this endorsement. And so that's definitely significant, that it was a very close vote. It's not like Tupperville ran away with it.
Right.
What's also significant about that, though, is that if it's going to be that close, if it was actually just that razor-thin close, among, you know, you're talking about 130 or 140 voting members, you know, you'd almost expect them to say, all right, well, let's sit this one out. If it's that close, let's hold our endorsement. Those two are probably going to be in the runoff anyway. So I was a little bit surprised to see him press forward and actually saying, yeah, we want to endorse, rather than saying, all right, let's just let them slug it out.
But and now people are saying this means there's not going to be the wisdom has been that there would be a runoff, and people are saying, yeah, probably not now.
Oh, I don't think that's so at all. I mean, Bradley Byrne still has a significant organization advantage over Tupperville. You know, look, it's a big setback, no question about it. But the close vote shows that he's got a lot of support in the farming community.
Yep.
I still think it's very likely this race goes to a runoff. We haven't seen a single advertisement aired on TV, and I haven't heard anything on the radio. Maybe they have. Maybe I don't think I have. So it's way too soon to be calling, you know, this landslide for Tupperville. We also haven't seen all the different mudslinging that can go on, all the opposition research. So, no, I fully expect this to go into a runoff. Those are the top two candidates. Look, things can change, but right now, yeah, I'd expect it to go in a runoff.
There we go. As always, man, I appreciate the conversation. Remind folks once again, the website, where do they go?
ALDailyNews.com. Be glad to have you as a subscriber. And you be good, Sean.
Well, I can't promise that, but I'll try. Todd Stacey, always a pleasure. Hey, coming right back, Quinn Hilliard joins us to talk about the legacy of AL1's former Congressman Jack Edwards. And what a story around Jack Edwards. We'll get to that next.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. And mentioned earlier, funeral arrangements on Wednesday for former Representative Jack Edwards. Talk about the history of Jack Edwards. History of Republicans in Alabama, I think, are intertwined. And after reading my buddy Quinn Hilliard's piece over at the Washington Examiner, that's all the more evident. Quinn's joining us now to talk more about it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Glad to be on with you.
Yeah, this is something that I mentioned in the morning show early on in the my family and Jack and Julian Edwards were friends, and I was around the congressman back then. I was a little kid. I was eight years old or so, and I didn't realize, you know, what a big deal it was. It was just some friends of my parents. But looking back at his legacy and also what was happening in politics in Alabama at that time, really a big deal of what happened with Representative Jack Edwards back in the 60s.
It was a very big deal. Other than his grandfather, who oddly enough was a Republican congressman at the right around 1900, there had been no Republican congressman from the Deep South since the end of Reconstruction anywhere.
Wow.
Anywhere. And then Goldwater ran on the Republican ticket in 1964, and there were, I'd said eight, but it turns out there were 7 Republicans across the Deep South that got elected in congressional races, sort of riding the coattails of Barry Goldwater. Most of them didn't last very long. They got elected the first time, and then they sort of faded away. Jack Edwards got elected and reelected easily for 20 years and could have stayed another probably 20 more if he had wanted to. He retired on his own terms. But so he was a big forerunner of the shift of the South from absolutely 100% solidly Democrat to where it's now very, very heavily Republican. He was a forerunner of that, and just on those political grounds, before you get to his policy successes, that makes him a remarkable figure, not just in Alabama, but in American political history.
Yeah, I want to go back and I want to visit, too, the changes in Alabama. But to younger members of the audience or people who weren't paying attention, Goldwater Republicans, Goldwater, what, talk about that. What was going on then with Goldwater? Why did you have these people riding his coattail? Why then?
Well, Goldwater carried Arizona plus five deep South states and lost the other, 44 states in the District of Columbia. And unfortunately, one reason that he carried the Deep South states was a misunderstanding. He, on very technical grounds, opposed the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. And he had said if they changed one provision in it that he thought was unconstitutional, he would support it. And this was typical Barry Goldwater. He was a stickler for the Constitution, and he had been for integration and friendly with the NAACP his whole career, but he took this stand because of the constitutional issue. Well, what happened was the general public saw was, here's this guy running for president, and he's standing against the Civil Rights Bill, and in the Deep South, that made him popular. So he carried these southern states, largely because of that, not entirely, but largely. And as he was carrying the states, he brought in some Republican congressmen with him. The irony is Jack Edwards was not one of these guys who was running an openly segregationist campaign, and was not a divider. He was a uniter for almost his entire time in Congress. But the
Yeah, it is ironic that that's. I mean, how that Republican of the metal of Jack Edwards comes in is on the coattails of misunderstanding of Goldwater policy. I just thought it was worth pointing out the nuance is important in this case.
Exactly, the nuance is very important, and for Goldwater's sake too, because he's gotten a bum rap all these years. People forget that he was actually much more pro civil rights in the 50s than John F. Kennedy was in the Senate, literally more pro-civil rights than Kennedy. So anyway, it's a very interesting sort of nuanced twist, but what we ended up with was Jack Edwards, who ended up going on and doing a great job for 20 years, represented Alabama very, very well, and became a point person on defense policy, helped lead Ronald Reagan's defense rebuild that. So good stuff.
Yeah, it is, and I want to get into, I want to talk more about why he was so successful. I mean, AL1 is the most important to us, being here in this area. But, it's not like AL1 comes with all the trappings of getting a whole bunch of stuff done in Washington. You have to make yourself a player in Washington. You have to make yourself somebody that is needed by other members of Congress and the White House.
Well, exactly. And Jack Edwards had built alliances across the aisle, as they say. Look, he was definitely conservative, but he was not a hardliner, and he would work with the Democrats. This was at the time when a lot of Southern Democrats were also pro-defense and unreasonably conservative on a lot of different things. And so he built friendships and alliances and proved to be trustworthy. And so spending a lot of years on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, moving up in the ranks, he became a defense policy expert, and he was trusted by all sides. So when Reagan came in, he was a senior Republican on that key subcommittee, and Reagan used him as one of the key point people to get the defense stuff through, because he had such good working relationships with the Democrats and were still in the majority. Just a really good story. And even after he retired, 4 years later, the so-called Base Realignment and Closure Commission, which was a big, huge military reform, one of the most successful in history. BRAC 1, the first version of it, was co-chaired by Jack Edwards. They pulled him out of retirement to do it. That shows the respect with which he was held.
Absolutely. If just joining us, talking to Quinn Hillier, his story up at the Washington Examiner, former Representative Jack Edwards, defense policy stalwart, RIP and RMP indeed. You also mentioned this, and this, of course, is close to my heart, about the conservation measures that then Representative Jack Edwards pushed. This was something that, while today, oh yeah, everybody's behind this, but in the early 1980s, this wasn't part and parcel of anybody, I think Democrats or Republicans.
Well, especially Republicans have what I think is sort of a bum rap of not caring about the ecology or the environment.
Right.
But a lot of Republicans, especially around here, hunters and fishermen, are certainly conservationists.
Right.
In the old sense of the word. And Jack Edwards understood that. And so Jack Edwards worked really hard and spearheaded the efforts to create the Weak Bay and the Bon Secours, the wildlife refuge in the latter, and the estuary, and I can't say that word, center in the former. But so two of the biggest, most important conservation creations here in southern Alabama were spearheaded by Jack Edwards.
You know, Quinn, the other part of this, too, that I think is the bigger history lesson. You mentioned what a big deal it was for this Republican to get elected in the super Democratic Alabama in the South back then. But then moving forward, it was interesting that as a spearhead, Jack Edwards comes in, makes it okay to have Republicans elected. But it was, if I'm right, it was Republicans could be elected in Alabama to go to Washington. That went on for decades while you had to be a Democrat still to go to Montgomery.
Well, yeah, except most of the Republicans that got elected in 64 to go to Washington, as I say, they didn't really last all that long.
Right.
But Jack Edwards did.
But eventually it started turning in Alabama, right? The Republicans did win for federal, but Jack Edwards was way in front of that. But eventually Republicans started winning for federal office, but it was obviously decades later for Montgomery.
Well, no, but only another 14 or 15 years later did, you know, back in the late 70s, did Republicans start winning.
That's
even
amazing.
To go to Washington. I mean, we didn't have a senator until we had a war hero with Jeremiah Dent in 1980.
Yeah, y'all think about that. Think about that much time, 14 or 15 years. Yet Representative Edwards, a Republican from AL1 in the furthest south in the southern mm-hmm. state of Alabama. I mean, quite a testament.
It was quite a testament. And again, the reason that he lasted is because he united people. He was, nobody's going to say that he couldn't play politics and work hard for what he wanted and put his foot down. It wasn't like he was, you know, namby-pamby or anything, but he was a gentleman. And he cared about civility. He cared about, you know, getting along with people, and it made him a revered figure in a way that, you know, that some of these other hard edge guys that got in, you know, they weren't as well liked and they didn't last. And I can say this one other thing that he did, and just show sort of his personality. When other younger congressmen got in to Washington from nearby states or whatever, he was one of these guys who served as a mentor. My former boss, Bob Livingston, got elected in 77. Jack Edwards had been there for 13 years already. And Jack Edwards reached out and became a mentor for him, got him, helped get him on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, taught him the ropes. That's the kind of thing that makes you stand out, because even back then in Washington, a lot of people were focused on themselves more than on helping bring other people along. So again, more power to him, because he was just a good man.
Yeah, and if you're looking at the, you know, if you're younger and say, well, I don't care about this history, but you're seeing the history, the fact that AL1 is a solidly Republican congressional district, and you can look through the timeline here. That timeline started with Jack Edwards, and where we are now with Bradley Byrne, but it went from Jack Edwards to Callahan and on down the line, that AL1 is this thing that people who are younger would just go, of course it's a Republican district. It was not always Republican.
Right. It was, I mean, it was not Republican from
Reconstruction
1878, something like 1878 until 1964, except for about 5 years with Jack Edwards' his grandfather, way back in about 1900. So basically, nearly a century, it was not Republican, except that Jack Edwards got in and not just won the seat, but held the seat for 20 years.
Well, it's a great write-up here, and I know we'll talk about it more on the show this week. Remind folks, if they want to go search out this story or other things you're writing, where do they go? And also, remind them about picking up the Matt Jones trilogy.
Matt Jones trilogy, fun, satirical works of fiction at Amazon.com. And meanwhile, you can follow me at Quinn Hillier, and Washington Examiner is the best way, probably, or QuinnHillier.com.
Hey, thanks, Quinn. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Quinn Hill, you're joining us in funeral services for Edwards. You're going to take place on Wednesday. That's going to be Wednesday, 2:30 at Trinity Presbyterian Church, which is, 545 South Mobile Street in Fairhope. We'll remind you more about that coming up in the next day or so. But that's going to be Wednesday, those funeral proceedings. All right. Coming right back, more of Midday Mobile.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Heck of a thing for a pharmacist to say, isn't it? 12:53 FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile Monday. By the way, online opinion poll question is moving here, and it was 100% earlier today one way, and I don't like that. It always worries me. Like, monolithic agreement always scares me, so it's good to see a little bit of movement here. Should the identity of the White House whistleblower be released? 78% of y'all still say yes, but 22% say no. You can vote online. Front page of our website, fmtalk1065.com. All right, run through some of these texts here, too. Tax Man saying Jack Edwards was a truly honorable man. Also, Tony says, used to go to his apartment at Lafayette Square when I was a kid, probably six or so. He seemed to enjoy the company. His wife, and if I remember correctly, liked to paint. I'd watch sometimes. They were nice people. I can second that. Tony, I was a youngster around him. Like that picture I put up on Twitter, I think that's me at 10 years old. I think I'm 10. I think that's 82 or 83 there. I think I was either 10 or 11 in that photo. It's a good-looking 11-year-old with working. By the way, I think those were corduroys. I had the corduroy pants on with the red sweater. That was back in the days before I got to choose what I put on clothing-wise. Tony goes on to say he invited my parents at dinner at Lambert Mim's house. Oh, wow. There were all three mayors. You know, Tony, do you look back at stuff like that that you got to do when you were a kid, and you're like, if I could have only been aware of what was going on. He said, I can't remember what it was, but it seemed to be a big event. It's interesting to talk to Quinn about that, the legacy of Jack Edwards. Now, obviously, I've told you, full disclosure, I'm a fan, known the man since I was a little kid, and friend of my parents, and he and his wife, Shirley, just the nicest folks around. But to look back and study, after I'd known him as a kid, but then to look at it academically and what he did in Alabama, do you know how big a deal that was? How big of a deal it was that a Republican won in AL1? It was huge. And it was, like Quinn described, he came in with five or six others that rode the Goldwater coattails in, but they quickly eroded away. And Jack Edwards was like this, you know, you picture a map, like when you see some kind of demographic map, a GIS map, and everything's like one color, and then there's something standing out, like a city state into itself. That's where Jack Edwards was as a Republican congressman in Alabama. And then over the decades, yes, then we started electing Republicans that would go to Washington. but still at home, we elected Democrats that went to Montgomery. Remember, it wasn't until, what is it, 10, 12 years ago now? The big switch over in Montgomery, maybe it's longer than that now. I'm getting old. 14 years ago, that you had the big shift in Montgomery. Remember that? It was all Democrat for the federal delegation and the state delegation. Then, being spearheaded by AL1's Jack Edwards, you started this, and he was by himself for a long time before other Republicans started winning, but they would win to go to Washington. They'd win for House. They'd win for Senate, right? And go to Washington, but still at home, it was Democrats going to Montgomery. And then decades later, that changed, and we know the where we are now in the state. So it's an interesting, I don't know, it's a interesting part of history of the nation and national politics, and then of course a very, very big part of Alabama politics and the change. Think about how big a change there has happened here in Alabama. Think about a state that could prior to the win for Jack Edwards in 65. There was no place that was more solidly Democrat, a Democrat win, than the state of Alabama. And now, of course, here in 2019, it's completely the contrary. Does that turn around one day? And someday people are saying, way back in 2019, you wouldn't believe this, but the state of Alabama, up and down the line, they controlled the House, they controlled the Senate. They did have a Democrat that won Senate one time for one term before he was removed. But other than that, it was all Republican. Can you believe that back then? History. Sometimes it changes, sometimes it stays the same. All right, I'll talk to you on the flip side here at 343-0106. Lots to get into. Like what New York City says you can't do now as well. They are they're banning free speech in New York. I'll get to that coming up.